Welcome to the Six Figure Developer Podcast, the podcast where we talk about new and exciting technologies, professional development, clean code, career advancement, and more. I am John Calloway.
I am Clayton Hunt.
And I am John Ash.
With us today is Reuven Lerner. Reuven helps developers around the world to become more fluent in Python. Welcome, Reuven.
Hi, guys. Nice to be here.
So, Reuven, would you care to tell us a little bit how you got started with the industry or in the industry?
Sure. So I went to college and got a computer science degree. I was always interested in computers, but quite frankly, didn't really know what programmers did and didn't really know what computer science was until I actually started majoring it. And I really enjoyed that. And then I got a job and discovered, wait, college isn't exactly like the industry either. But I still enjoyed what I was doing. And so I started off when I graduated. I worked for HP for about 2 years. And they had a call from some friends to work for Time Warner, which was then starting up their web development division. And I had started one of the first websites back when I was in college. And so after a little bit of negotiation and thinking, do I really want to move back to New York? Do I not? I moved there. And it turned out to be a life-changing thing because then I discovered, oh, this web thing, it might actually be big someday. And maybe I should get it on the ground floor here and maybe I can like make a career out of it. And so I worked there for about 8 months or so, and then I moved to Israel, and I planned to be a freelancer, and the people at Time Warner were very nice and said, well, we'll be your first client. So I basically, they sort of, don't tell them this because they'll want like shares or something, but they were basically like the first investors in my freelancing career. And so I've been doing it since 1995, somehow paying the mortgage, three kids, eating and so forth. And so I've always done some combination of development, consulting, and training. I started off doing mostly Perl, Linux, web type stuff. And over the years, I sort of moved more into doing, for a long while, I was doing Ruby. And over the last 10, 15 years, it's been mostly Python stuff. Always open source. And over the last 10 years, I guess, I've moved more and more into doing just training as opposed to development. Here and there, I do a little development. Here and there, I do some consulting. But I would say in a typical month, let's say there are 20 work days, I probably spend 18 of those teaching frontally in front of companies around the world.
And you're also a panelist on the Freelancer show. Is that correct?
Yes. So in my copious free time, I also do. I am a panelist on the Freelancer show. I write a column for Linux Journal for about 20 years now, every month. And I've written some books, and I produce some courses that I sell online as well. And occasionally my family remembers what I look like.
So what was it like making the transition from the full-time role at Time Warner, you said, into freelancing and making the move to Israel around the same time?
So basically, it couldn't have been easier. They really were super, super nice and great about it. I had no idea what I was doing in terms of freelancing. Basically, this guy at HP, when I'd worked there, he had been a contractor. And when everyone else went out to a meeting, it was him and me not going because I was a student intern and he was a contractor, not allowed to go. And I said to him, so why aren't you going? He said, I have the best job ever. I am a contractor. I make loads of money going from company to company. I was like, whoa, this sounds really great. So that was roughly everything I knew about consulting before I decided I was going to try it too. And adding into the mix, I would switch countries also. So basically I arrived in Israel knowing I wanted to try it, knowing I had a client in hand, and then giving it a go. And I figured the worst possible situation was that I would just sort of get a real job. The best possible situation actually sort of worked out, which was, hey, it worked. And they gave me enough income that I could start to look around for local clients. And even at that time in the mid-90s, you could get some remote work online for doing what I was doing then, Perl and Linux and web work. And over time, it just sort of grew and grew, in part because, and perhaps this is obvious, but as you continue consulting and as you specialize, people get to know you for doing whatever it is, X. And so people in high tech switch jobs all the time, right? They're moving from company to company. And so when they get to a new company and someone says, oh, I wish we had someone who did X, someone will be like, oh, wait, we had Reuven and he worked on X on a previous project. And so from, word of mouth alone, you can actually get a fair number of clients. I mean, assuming you don't tick too many people off, that is. I know. Try as I might. And so, look, when I got here, I remember speaking to an accountant because I had to set up a company and so forth. And he said, have you ever run a company in the U.S.? You know, did you ever run a company in the U.S. before you came to Israel? I said, no. He said, great. You will think the way we do things here is normal because you have no baseline to compare it with. And then we actually spent 4 years. I did a PhD at Northwestern. So we were living in Chicago. And true enough, then dealing with my company stuff in the U.S. and my taxes there seemed completely insane because it's just a totally different system. So it's all what you're used to at the end of the day.
Well, so I was curious. You said you have some online training and then also in-person training where you travel the world. How much of your time are you actually traveling and doing training?
A surprising amount. Look, to some degree, I can control it, right? Like, so I can propose to different companies when I'd like to go to them. Like, I now have a bunch of large company clients where I can propose dates to them and they'll say yay or nay. This is especially true. I have a big client that I do a lot of work with in Europe. And then it's actually a training company with whom I subcontract for going to China. So certainly in China, basically, assuming it's not one of their holidays, I can say to them, hey, would you like me to come this week? And you might have heard China's kind of large. And so they can usually find something for me to go do. The company in Europe, it's a little more touch and go, but typically that can happen. And then I've started going to the US a bit as well. And that's, you know, a bit of a longer, longer flight from Israel. It turns out that I now travel internationally about once every 6 weeks. I'm trying to ratchet that down a little bit. But basically it's sort of hard to say no, both because I want to, like, you know, both because it's fun, let's be honest, and because I'm trying to develop connections with clients and sort of get in their good graces so that then I can figure out exactly where and what I want to do. But one of the nice things about training is that's typically scheduled very far in advance. So I can sort of plan my calendar out and say, okay, this month I'll go one place and then I have holidays, I have family stuff, so I won't go during this 2 month period and so forth.
All right, that's nice. What about the online training? Is that in person or is it instructor led or is it more like a video course where it's mostly passive income?
So there's three different types of online training that I do. One is for clients. So like right before we started recording here, so I'm doing actually an online class for a company in the US and basically they're just having me do WebEx. And no, it's not as effective as me being there frontally, but it costs them less because they don't have to fly me out. It's easier for me because I don't have to fly out and be with my family. The time zone thing is a little weird, but you know, every so often doing that is not so terrible. So that's like one kind. And there, it's basically the same thing that I do, just without the in-person touch. The second kind of online training I do is indeed the sort of recorded video courses. And I have a growing array of courses that basically I record and then people can buy, typically B2C. So it's individual developers who want to improve their skills who are buying my Python, Git, and so forth courses. Here and there, I've had some companies buy site licenses. One of my clients has decided they want more of my time. And so they decided to start buying my online courses as a complement to or supplement to what I do for them in person. But then I have a third kind of course that I've been working on called a weekly Python exercise. And that is actually an email course. It's a paid email course where every Tuesday you get a Python puzzle problem. And the following Monday you get an answer. And in between, there's a forum people can talk to each other on. And so I have like 150 people in the current cohort. And so every week, like a bunch of them, certainly not all of them, but like a bunch of them, the active ones talk to each other. And I participate a bit. And then I try to have monthly, bi-monthly office hours to talk to them and answer any questions people might have. And that's like the least frontal, but the most community participatory. Actually, the one I'm sort of most proud of because it's different and interesting. And it forces people sort of think on their own. But if they really need help, they've got a community to use as a crutch.
Okay. And I think I saw that one on your website. Is that the year-long course?
Yeah, it's currently a year long. I'm probably going to be restructuring it so it's a little shorter because people are like, oh my God, a year long. Are you kidding? And I do see, did see like some drop off. And I did a survey last time I started the latest cohort and a bunch of people said it was also a bit expensive. So if I can cut down the time, it also cut down the expense. And I'm probably going to have now like basic. I'm going to start a new one in January, like intro A and B, each of them being like 20 weeks. And then I'll take the current one and make it like advanced, like C and D, as it were. So you'll still get all the content. It'll just be broken into parts and people can choose whatever schedule is good for them.
All right. And then so one last thing that I was curious about for training is, and you sort of alluded to it with the in-person training where you're actually going and visiting some place is the most lucrative.
Mm-hmm.
But what's kind of the breakdown? Like, I would assume there's something where the less in-person it is, the more reach you have, but also the less, I don't know, it's probably not the right word, but less commission you get for the training. So how does that all work out?
Absolutely. So look, in-person training is an industry. It's an industry with a lot of players. And moreover, it's something that companies want to spend money on. I often describe like the person, my actual client, sort of as crass as it is to say, is not the people sitting in my classroom. My actual client is the training manager. Why? Because they have this budget. They're going to spend it. And if it's a good training, right, then they look good in their boss's eyes. And if it's bad, well, then they look bad. And so they're going to try to increase their, you know, star power at the company by bringing in, you know, the more training. But the budget is actually pretty generous. You know, European and US companies, it's not atypical to get $5,000-$6,000 a day for training. Meaning you go and do 4 days of training, you can get like $20,000 or more. Which, you know, not so bad, given that you're typically going to be giving the same sort of course again and again. And, you know, every company will say, I love it. Companies will say, our people are smarter than average. They don't really need 4 days. They can do it in three. So, like, this is the Lake Wobegon effect gone wild, where, like, how can it be that every company's employees are smarter than average? And they also have to understand, like, these things just take time to percolate into the brain. But for sure, and then, you know, Israeli and Chinese rates are definitely a bit lower than that, although there's always some play in the industry. Places will also sort of pay per person, per day. So there are all these sort of variables you can play with. At the end of the day, though, they are paying for someone to come and be there in person. There's definitely a premium they're paying for that. And for sure, the reason that I'm recording courses is to get out to more people, to people who I can't service because I don't have the time, they don't have the budget, they're individuals, and so forth. What I'm seeing with this client of mine that is sort of supplementing my in-person courses with online stuff, they first have gotten a directive to reduce frontal classroom hours, partly as a budget thing and partly as a timing thing. And also they will sort of want to use my time better. So what they decide is, like, for example, they're now using my Git course and they've told everyone, okay, you have until like Thursday of this week to get through the first half of Reuven's Git course. Do it whenever you want. You can do it on your commute. You can do it, you know, while you're at work, whenever is good for you. And then they added to that an in-person meeting because they do see that as an important thing. So they sort of, you know, paid for an add-on to the online course. And I wouldn't be surprised if I have a growing number of courses like that in the future, where it's what's sometimes called blended learning. Like, you do some of the learning on your own and some of the learning in the classroom. And in particular there, when I'm in person, I'm going to be doing exercises, collaborative exercises that you can't do online by yourself. And I'm going to be answering questions that people, well, so far have not asked anything in the forum. So there you go.
All right, cool.
How much of this progression in your career was just happenstance, or how much of it was planned? You've gone from development and consulting and then into training. Is this just kind of a natural progression? Was it planned? Was it just luck of the draw? And is it just you're constantly refining and improving and delivering what's being asked of you, or how did that all come about?
So first of all, a few years ago, I looked at my eighth grade graduation yearbook, and you know how it always says, what do you plan to do? And I was a little surprised to see that it said, I want to be a computer engineer, write books, and teach. So I did not, however, like, from the point I was in eighth grade, like, map out my career in this way. What basically happened was I figured I would be, okay, you know, an engineer, and I would be, yep. I sort of first thought I'd work for a company somewhere. In fact, when I was working for HP, they moved to a different location and I had to start, like, you know, I had to buy a car. I had to commute. It was really a pain. If I had any brains at all, I was living in, like, Cambridge, Massachusetts. There were a bunch of other companies. There were a bunch of other startups, but never dawned on me. So, like, my eyes had to open a little bit. When I started consulting, people started asking me, would I do training so that I wouldn't come in and do things, but I'd teach their employees. But it never dawned on me that training would be this separate thing I could do. It was always like, well, you could pay me for my time to program. You could pay me for my time to teach your people to program. Like, it doesn't really matter. And it only happened to be that I bumped into someone I knew once, and I was doing training. He was doing training at the same place. Well, let me back up. Like, when I was still finishing my PhD dissertation, I ran into someone, and he said, you know, why don't you just have a training company market you, and then you'll fill up your schedule really well. I was like, oh, that's an interesting idea. And so my schedule started to fill up, but I was basically earning the same as I was programming until I bumped into this other guy I knew who was training at the same place I was on the same day. And he said to me, you're earning what? I'm earning twice that. And that's when I realized, oh, trainers actually make a lot, especially if they're working on their own, not through a training company. And that takes time to develop, right? You have to develop the skills, you have to develop the contacts. And that's when the sort of penny half dropped. And then at a certain point, I made the strategic decision to leave the training company I've been working with, go back to doing it on my own. And that's when companies started saying to me, well, we want to schedule, you know, 2, 3, 4, 6, 8 months in advance. So we're recording this in mid-November. I basically don't have any free days until June of 2019. Now, granted, people will cancel and so forth. And I have like, you know, holidays and personal time in there. But these big companies love to fill time and they have lots of people. So it actually makes it fairly easy in that sense.
So this kind of moves a little bit away from the training, the development, consulting, but you've mentioned a number of different technologies that you have been kind of working with and also training and whatnot. So why Python right now?
I learned Python back in 92 when I was in college and we were setting up a website. Back then, Perl and Python were sort of in this, you know, death match, you know, among the 1,000 programmers who actually existed back then. But like, basically, you know, which was going to be superior. And so I, for a long time, sort of clutched onto to Perl as a language. I would say, oh, well, you know, it's great for doing all sorts of different things. I can write it really quickly. And at a certain point, Perl sort of took a nosedive. I often say that Python didn't win, Perl committed suicide. apologies to the Perl people out there. Don't send me hate mail. I mean, send me hate mail, sure. There's all like 2 of you left. But I actually didn't jump whole hog onto the Python bandwagon right away. I said, well, Ruby is actually very similar to Perl, just has real objects in it. So for a long time, I was doing Ruby stuff and Rails stuff, and I really enjoyed it. And it was only when I started working with this training company here in Israel that they said, well, what do you want to train in? And I said, Ruby. And they sort of sneered and said, well, send us your resume and like, we'll see. And within an hour or two, they called me back and they said, oh my God, you know Python. Do you know how much demand there is for Python? So I was like, sure, I'll do Python training too. I know it. I use it. I like it. And basically, I discovered how deep the language is and the community is. And it's sort of astonishing to me see how it is everywhere now. My 15-year-old is in an entrepreneurship program, and she learned Python. University students are learning Python. Everyone data science is learning Python. The appetite for Python is basically insatiable. And so I went from being someone who said, what a great language. And for years, I was saying, the first language everyone should learn is Python, to your first instinct should probably be to use Python, not necessarily because it's the best at everything, because it's clear, easy. And I often also say that the problem today is not developing software. The problem is maintaining software. And Ruby and Perl might allow you all sorts of crazy stuff. But that's a problem. They allow you all sorts of crazy stuff. And the next person who comes in is going to have to maintain it. And how often have you seen code and been like, who was the idiot who wrote this? Oh my God, it was me, right? Like, and you're sort of embarrassed that you don't remember what you did or how you did it because you're showing off to yourself that day. And so the chances of that happening in Python are lower. And so I've been in the last decade impressed increasingly with many of the design decisions that went into the language and its flexibility. And I'm now a whole hog Python person, although I do have many soft spots for a particular Ruby.
I assume you're doing Python 3 or 4 or whatever. Like, I know the 2-3 switch was rough. I don't know what they're actually up to.
So they're up to 3. It's funny. I would sometimes mention to my classes, well, such and such will be in Python 4. You know, the version my great-grandchildren will use. On the assumption that, like, under no circumstances would they dare just like upgrade to Python 4 now after the 2-3 switch. And then I was at the Python conference at PyCon earlier this year, and someone actually seriously mentioned Python 4, and I could not believe it, but apparently they're talking about it. I'll tell you, I personally use Python 3 now for everything. I think I made the switch completely about a year and a half ago. In my training, though, it's up to the companies. And my smaller company clients are switching to Python 3. That's not a question because they don't have an installed base. The larger companies are split. Some of them have said, we can't do anything. I have one company that I work with that does incredible amounts of testing of their hardware using Python. They've written a huge amount of C code that talks to Python, and it's all written for Python 2. Heaven help them when they have to upgrade. My C is not strong enough to help them at all. But like, they're stuck. And so they've said, no, we're going to use Python 2 and we're going to keep trading Python 2. And it's not like the Python police are going to arrest them for like continuing to use 2 in another year or two. But a growing number of my clients are even saying, you know, we're using Python 2. Teach us Python 3. Because for humans, the distinction is not that huge. But for the computer, it's pretty big. And someone who learns 3 can always sort of, you know, backport their mind, as it were, to use 2. So I'd say now it's about like a 75-25 split, 3-2.
So without revealing any client secrets, what are the types of industries or the types of problems that your clients are using Python to solve?
So a lot of them. So, as I said before, I'm like, you know, originally a web guy. And so I expected, okay, people are going to call me in to do Python training using, you know, for web and database. And that is completely false. It's like... I would say a good 60% in testing, like whether they're testing hardware or testing networks, testing systems. Another good percentage is network communication. They're doing all sorts of analysis of log files. Huge, huge, huge numbers of people are analyzing log files and text using Python. I teach regular expression classes at some of these companies, and people come in basically say, I need to know how to parse log files. Like, that's what I do all day, and I'm doing it poorly. I mean, they never say that, but yeah, they mean that. and I would say a growing number are also interested in doing data science type stuff, whether it's just the sort of crunching, analyzing, or some of them even are using it for machine learning. So I've got one client that does a lot of network stuff. And so they're starting to use machine learning for outlier analysis of like, you know, we have 100 million logins in the last month. Let's figure out which are the unusual ones so that we can try to pinpoint possible security problems. And then you've got like a smorgasbord of other stuff going on. But it's very far away from what I ever expected. And yet their problems and what they need to learn are still roughly the same. Because once you understand the core language, like you'll understand the basic data types, you understand working with files, you're set, right? Like then you can just, you know, the world's your oyster.
Yeah, it seems that data science and machine learning are the big terms and being associated with Python these days. Do you have any tips and tricks on people that are interested in getting into data science, machine learning, using Python?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of good stuff out there. There's some good books. Jake Vanderplas's book, I think it's called The Data Science Handbook from O'Reilly, is a great, solid introduction. But just there's a huge amount out there, and it's overwhelming at first. You feel like, oh my God, I've got to master Python programming, and I've got to master these ideas, and I've got to learn NumPy and Pandas, and I've got to learn scikit-learn. And it takes time. So give yourself time, but it's certainly possible, and it's fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating stuff. I'd taken about a year of statistics and then used it in my doctoral dissertation. So I like had some background in that. I haven't really used that statistical stuff that much in like the data science stuff I've been doing, but I feel like at least gave me sort of an introduction to the language. But it's still like I've been teaching now for about 4 years, and every month, every 2 months, I'm still learning something. I say, oh my God, I can't believe I didn't know this. And thus I fold it into my class. And also one of the fun things for me is people ask me questions in class, and then I'm like, oh, I didn't know that. And I warned them about this in advance. Like I say, look, you're going to ask me questions. I'm not going to do the answer. I'm going to do my research. I'm going to learn about it. And that's going to add to my knowledge as well as yours. It's a huge field. And so you should expect you're not going to know everything, even after a long time. But that's also part of the fun and the interest. And that's what everyone feels. Everyone feels sort of in an inferiority complex. So just get started whenever you can, and you'll be able to find all sorts of like cool, fun stuff. I'll try to add to you guys like in the show notes, one or two good resources that people can go to for newsletters about data science with some good introductions and articles there.
One question, this is sort of a little bit around the training, but what are the levels of people that you're seeing that are these like mostly junior people that don't have little programming experience, or they're cross training into, you know, they have lots of C or Java or .NET experience and they're trying to make the shift. What kind of people are you seeing? Is it just a mix?
It's a mix, but the most popular course I teach is still like my intro Python course. I probably give that like once a month or something, sometimes even twice a month. The typical people there are junior mid-level engineers who have a background in C, C++, C#, Java. And their company has told them, you're going to start using Python for blah, like some, typically not as their main language, but as a language they're going to use. And so they need an introduction to the language, not introduction to programming, but introduction to sort of thinking in Python. And they could read a book. So my purpose is not to throw syntax at them, but to get them into the sort of the mode of thinking. So they don't, like, as I call it, program Python with a Java accent. Right. And it's like, we all, you know, you speak a foreign language, and that's the way it sort of works. And so getting them to think Pythonically, as we like to say in the Python world, is sort of an important part of what I try to do. That said, what would typically happen is after teaching that, so I teach that, like I have an intro course, I have an advanced course as well, particularly for people who've gone through that and then spent 6 months in the field and they can come back. But after I started teaching that course for a while, just about every time there'd be one or two people who come up to me after class the first day and say, wow, that was kind of tough. I don't really have much of a programming background. I'd say, oh, today was the easy day. Right? Wait till we get to functional programming and objects. And they'd be like, oh, no. So I work together with some of my clients, and I now have an intro to Python for non-programmers. And I basically cut away about half to two-thirds of the content. And typically people there are sales engineers, integration engineers, network engineers, sysadmins, who maybe took a programming class in college and were freaked out by it, or don't remember it, or hated it, or some combination of the above. But they need it now. So many companies are saying you need to know Python to do something, glue. And so that's slower, easier. And they also feel more comfortable asking questions because they know they're not going to, you know, hold back the more advanced people. Not that I would mind. And then I have a smattering of, like, you know, people from testing and so forth. But that's like a pretty typical profile.
Well, one of the things that we ask everyone is if you just give some advice to people that are just getting started, and sort of speak to, you know, some words of wisdom that you might have for people that are just trying to grow and they're trying to learn. So probably a perfect person to talk to, you know, because you're speaking to those people all the time. So
I push on two points. One, and perhaps this goes without saying, like, our industry is one in which you have to keep learning. Right. If you just sort of stick with what you already know, you're going to fall behind, both where you're working now and where you work in the future. So you have to just get into the mode of always reading, always trying, always experimenting, be it with new technologies or new techniques within the existing technologies. But that leads to the question of, well, which technology? What should I do? And the answer is, it doesn't matter. Pick one. And I want to emphasize, pick one, because basically, you want to be like the big fish in the small pond. You want to be the expert in a small community. And so I had this problem when I had my consulting company years ago and I had like 5-6 employees. And by the way, it's now like me and I have a part-timer who works for me and I'm so much happier, like not having to worry about like paying all these salaries and everything. But we said, we will use whatever language you want. We are willing to go that way. And that was totally the wrong approach. By specializing in Python, I've made myself more valuable, more visible. Like, I ran into someone, I was at the train station in Haifa a few months ago, and I sit down on a bench, and this guy sits down next to me, turns to me, says, hey, you do Python training, right? I was like, whoa, this guy. He said, yeah, you gave me a course, I think it was 7-8 years ago. So the more you can sort of identify with one specialty, the better it is for your career. And if you switch, that's okay too. But by trying to be the big fish in the small pond, you'll find there's almost infinite depth to anything you learn, and people will respect you more for it.
Do you have any? Well, why don't we give you an opportunity? I think you did mention that you are on Twitter, but are there any other places that people might sort of be able to follow and find? Well, you have your training to plug, and just kind of give you an opportunity to tell people where to come and find you.
Sure, we've got like another hour, right? All right. Anyway. So I am on Twitter, but I'm not that active on Twitter, actually. I have a blog at blog.learner.co.il. We'll put up the URL. I have a weekly newsletter that goes out to about 10,000 people now as of this recording called Better Developers. Why? I don't know. But like the idea is basically we all want to become better developers. And this is sort of me coming up with things that I've learned that I think other people will like. It's mostly Python, but not only. I also, and you can get to that via my website, learner.co.il. I also have another newsletter that I put out called Trainer Weekly, which is for people interested in the business and logistics and pedagogy of training. That's also my website or at trainerweekly.com. And then I've got a whole bunch of my books and my courses are all available via my online store at, that's right, store.learner.co.il. And co.il, for those of you who haven't figured out, is corporations in Israel. That's the domain. And I'd be very, very happy to hear from anyone who has questions. I'm really happy to interact, especially in training, but not only. So feel free to reach out. I'd be delighted to be in touch with listeners.
Are you doing any more traveling in coming months or any upcoming speaking engagements?
Speaking, I'm not planning that much, although I'm hoping to get something accepted at PyCon this year in May in the U.S. I'm supposed to be in Eugene, Oregon in the beginning of December. Hopefully that will work out. I'm supposed to hear from the next day or two. And then I will be in Guangzhou and Shanghai at the end of December. And then probably in London and Krakow in January and February, because, you know, there's nothing like winter in Poland to feel really super refreshing. That was perhaps not the smartest time to schedule going there, but I'm sure the flights are cheap.
All right, Ruben. Well, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thanks, guys, for having me on.
That was Ruben Lerner. Ruben helps developers around the world to become more fluent in Python.
If you liked this episode, please like, rate, and review on iTunes.
Find show notes, blog posts, and more at sixfiguredev.com.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at sixfiguredev.
This has been another episode of the Six Figure Developer Podcast, helping others reach their potential. I am John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I'm John Ash. Mm-hmm.